There is no consensus on the overall genre of the Book of Job. As a matter of fact, in Joban's scholarship, there is hardly any consensus, except the acknowledgement that the Book of Job is the literary masterpiece. That said, at the surface level, the Book of Job is a narrative. What I mean by narrative is a telling of connected sequence of events recounted by a narrator. To facilitate the discussion of reading narratives, I will borrow some insights from literary critic James Phelan, who views narrative as rhetoric. That is, having a purpose of communicating knowledge, feelings, values, and beliefs. A crucial concept that Phelan introduces is narrative progression, which he defines as the synthesis of the narrative's internal logic as it unfolds from beginning through middle to end, with the developing interests and responses of the audiences to that unfolding. In examining progression, the audiences are thus compelled to be involved in considering narratives as developing wholes. As they engage with the story, they seek to establish a coherent configuration of the story by developing interests in the mimetic, thematic, and synthetic components of the narrative and generate corresponding responses. The way in which these interests are cultivated is through the author's use of conflicts, the focus of the audience's interests. Phelan defines two main types of unstable relations within narrative. He says, in general, the story discourse model of narrative helps to differentiate between two main kinds of instabilities. The first are those occurring within the story, instabilities between characters created by situation and complicated and resolved through actions. The second are those created by the discourse, instabilities of value, belief, opinion, knowledge, expectation between authors and or narrators on the one hand, and the authorial audience on the other. The importance of paying attention to a narrative's progression is that it allows one to grasp the way in which the text invites reader to construct a coherent reading experience of the story as rhetoric. What is the central problem in the Book of Job? Again, there is no consensus. A number of scholars, however, have argued that one major theme is appropriate religious expressions in the context of suffering, and this is the approach that I'm taking. As we all know from Biblical Interpretation 101, repetition often indicates emphasis. In the prologue, that is the first two chapters of Job, several words and phrases are repeated. I will only mention two of them. First is the verb kata, to sin. The first occurrence is in the context of the so-called Job's preemptive sacrifice. And then in the narrator's evaluation of Job's first response. And finally, in the narrator's evaluation of Job's second response. As you can see from the highlighted text here, every time when the verb kata is used, the context is always speech to or about God. Second is the verb barak, to bless. First, in the Satan's assessment of the rationale behind Job's piety. And then in Job's first verbal response. Besides these two obvious occurrences, the Hebrew verb barak actually appears four more times in the prologue. We have seen this before. Believe it or not, the Hebrew word for curse here is barak, to bless. It is generally assumed that we have a euphemism here. To say to curse God explicitly is being considered as inappropriate. Another term is thus substituted to mean to curse. The same holds true for the other three occurrences. In the Satan's proposal in the first round, in his proposal in the second round, and in the only line of Mrs. Job. Some interpreters have rightly argued that the verb barak needs not to be read euphemistically in each case here. At any rate, whether the verb barak is taken ordinarily or euphemistically in each of these verses, the concern is still on how to speak to or about God in the midst of suffering. The phenomena of this standard euphemism theory can thus be explained as a fear of the effective power of the words spoken. Perhaps what is at stake is the mentality behind such a belief. When we turn to Job chapter 3, the narrator employs the phrase, Job opened his mouth to describe the breaking of silence. The mouth, which is an organ of speech, recalls another organ of speech, the lips, in the narrator's evaluation of Job's response earlier. This deliberate link turns the reader's attention to ponder whether Job is going to sin in his speech to come. The root barak, which has occupied such a prominent position in the prologue, never reappears in Job chapter 3. To take its place, three other verbs that can mean curse show up in this chapter. The narrator begins with an explicit statement that Job cursed his day, apparently his day of birth. By recalling this motif, the narrator intensifies the tension established in the prologue regarding the nature of Job's speech. In the first trophy of Job's outcry, he uses the form of a curse to express his impossible desire that he has never been born. At verse 8, Job imagines himself urging those who curse the day and those who are skilled to rouse up Leviathan to curse against the night of his conception. Job's curse of his day of birth and his unrestrained use of terms to mean to curse are in stark contrast to the narrator's reluctance to use the word explicitly in relation to God in the prologue. Again, this strongly suggests that the appropriateness of one's speech is the focalization of the story. Let us turn to the first speech of Eliphaz, the first friend of Job. He begins his speech with a couple of rhetorical questions. Can we lift up a word to you? You will be unable to bear it. But to hold back words, who can endure? At the end of the prologue, we are told that when Eliphaz and the other two friends first came to comfort and console Job, no one has spoken a word to Job for 7 days. The silence of the friends is conventionally understood as an expression of sympathy. Suppose we take the verbal connection between 4:2 and 2:13 as intentional, then Eliphaz here offers his own version of the rationale behind their silence. No one has lifted up a word to Job because Eliphaz believes that Job could not have brought it if anyone has done so. What is implied is that the nature of the words they plan to offer is not consolatory, but confrontational. What is most ironic is that after Job has opened his mouth to curse the day of his birth, Eliphaz is not shy to admit that he cannot endure to hold back his torrent of words anymore. Up to chapter 3, the instability mainly surrounds Job's inner struggle, or at best, between the conflict between Job and God. Eliphaz's response to Job develops this conflict into a human social problem. The initial intended consolation has now turned into a disputation. In using first-person plural as self-identification, Eliphaz sees the conflict as not only between Job and himself alone, but also between Job and the three friends or even the group of people who holds a similar view. According to Philan, the reader is compelled to respond to the thematic dimensions of a character. In other words, what kind of person does Eliphaz typify? One foundational element of Eliphaz's philosophy of life is exemplified in the speech that he offered. In short, he appears to endorse a strict retributive system in which the pious prosper and the evildoers perish in the long run. To account for the occasional misdeed of a pious person, He draws from another source of revelation, namely a vision he claims to have received, to argue that no mortal can be absolutely righteous before God. All God-fearing people should thus treat suffering as a form of divine discipline. Many have correctly noticed that it would be a mistake to see that retributive theology by itself is the ideology under attack. From the vantage point of the narrative up to this point, what makes Eliphaz's speech problematic is not so much the worldview he expresses. The real issue is the context in which he applies the philosophy to life situations. To be more precise, Eliphaz is characterized as a person who uses conventional religious language to respond to a friend whom he thinks is facing a crisis in faith. The provocative outburst of Job in chapter 3 deeply disturbs Eliphaz and prompts him to speak up. Carol Newsom says it best. The person who behaves inappropriately or who rejects the traditional formulas is seen as a threat to the community's worldview, even if no one would be comfortable in admitting it. There are a few instances where Eliphaz appears to take issue with Job's protest. For instance, after describing the fate of the evildoers, Eliphaz makes use of the metaphor of lions. Biblical authors like lions sometimes. Eliphaz makes use of the lions to strengthen his point in 4:10-11. He states that the roar of the lion is put to an end as they perish for lack of prey. In his opening outcry, Job complains that his sides are like his bread and his groans pour out like water. Eliphaz's deliberate allusion is best seen as a critique of Job's groaning. In other words, the groaning action is considered as one of the characteristic behaviors of the evildoers, and it should be put to an end. After all, this is the very reason why Eliphaz has spoken up in the first place. Moreover, the proverb, "Vexation kills the fool and jealousy slays the simple," recited by Eliphaz in 5:2, strongly suggests that his accusation against Job focuses on the impatience expressed through Job's unrestrained complaint. At least, Job takes it that way, as indicated by the opening of his following speech. Another relevant passage is Job 5:8-16, which contains Eliphaz's hypothetical confession and model doxology. Eliphaz uses "to seek God," an expression commonly used of inquiries addressed to God in the midst of crisis situations, to summarize what his response would be if he should suffer similar calamity. In fact, under the circumstances, a prayer of lament would perhaps be an appropriate response. Eliphaz, however, unexpectedly models for Job a doxology in praise of God's power and providence. This may be interpreted as Eliphaz boasting of his own extraordinary faith. A better explanation is that Eliphaz seeks to counter the dissembling cursed lament of Job in chapter 3 with words of affirmation and praise of God, whose power, wisdom, and justice maintain the equilibrium of the created order. Let us now turn to the first speech of Bildad, the second friend of Job. Bildad also begins his first speech by bringing the topic of appropriate religious expressions to the foreground. He says, "How long will you speak these things? Your utterances are a mighty wind." It seems clear that what motivates Bildad to speak up is the provocative speeches uttered by Job earlier. Bildad's expression, "a mighty wind," here is an allusion to the words of Job in 6:26. There, Job complains that the friends have considered what he said as mere wind, that is, insignificant and meaningless. In response, Bildad describes Job's words as a mighty wind, which is tempestuous and devastating. This verbal battle further intensifies the instability between Job and his three friends. Although the technique of decrying the opponent's arguments as mere words is common in wisdom disputation in the ancient Near East, The unusual frequency of such remarks in the book of Job strongly implies that proper speech to and about God is itself the issue at stake. Concerning Job, Builder lists two conditions for him to fulfill in order to receive God's restoration. The first criterion is that he must approach God in the spirit of true piety, seeking God and making supplication or imploring the favor of God. The terms Builder uses may refer to general expressions of worship and prayer. The same terms may also denote an act of repentance and a request for forgiveness. In either way, Bildad appears to encourage Job to appeal to the traditional motifs such as petition and confession of sin in the Psalms of Lament in order to secure his prosperous restoration. The second criterion, according to Bildad, is that Job must be morally pure and upright. Bildad assures Job that God would rouse himself for Job and restore his rightful place as long as Job satisfies all these prerequisites. The verb translated as rouse is also typical of the language of psalmody, in which the psalmist laments the absence and the inactivity of God and calls upon him to wake up. Builder's frequent use of the terminology in lament may be seen as a deliberate correction to Job's excessive misuse of the same language in his previous speeches. Like Eliphaz's advice, Builder's teaching implicitly affirms the piety-prosperity nexus, which is the issue at stake in the heavenly conversation between Job and the Satan. The intervention of Builder thus continues to complicate this previously established conflict between Job and his friends. Builder's speech comes to an end with a prediction of the joyful prosper in store for Job and the disgraceful destiny of his enemies. The language in verse 21 is verbally very close to Psalm 126 verse 2a, the setting of which is associated with deliverance from calamity. Moreover, the depiction of the destruction of the psalmist's enemies is another motif in lament. Ironically, the enemies, like Builders and his other two friends, are sometimes described as persons who turn against the one who suffers because they take such suffering as proof of sin. Again, Builder appears to supply to Job the missing elements of a standard lament so as to rehabilitate his friend from his crisis of faith, as Builder sees it. As is the case with Eliphaz, the reader is compelled to respond to the thematic component of Builder and ask what kind of person he typifies. As Nielsen puts it, Builder is presented as the type of the rigid doctrinaire moralist who loses his humanity in his desire to perceive the world according to a set of rules. Like Eliphaz, he espouses the doctrine of retribution in the most extreme sense and allows no individual exception of the rules. Perhaps the mentality underlying the character of Builder is the object with which the author intends to take issue. Finally, let's turn to the first speech of Sophar, the third friend of Job. In opening his response to Job, Sophar rebukes Job for his boastful words. He uses a rhetorical question to assure Job that his multitude of words will surely be answered. The verb ana is a common term. Nevertheless, in the preceding speech, Job uses this word exclusively, in the forensic sense, the legal sense. He states either that he could not answer Anna God or that God would not answer Anna him seriously in a legal setting. In this present speech, Sophar picks up Job's legal language and is prepared to prove Job's words to be in the wrong. Implicitly, Sophar has taken up Job's legal challenge on behalf of God and is prepared to answer Job. Sophar's sharp rhetoric further intensifies the instabilities in the narrative. Eliphaz only implicitly suggested that he could not hold back his words because of Job's opening provocative outcry. Similarly, Bildad only pronounced himself offended by Job's destructive words. Sofer considers it a moral duty of anyone to shame Job by answering him. One characteristic feature of Job's present speech is that he apparently quotes the words of Job in order to refute them. The words that Sofer attributes to Job are, "My teaching is pure and I am clean in your sight." Well, if you look closely and comparing the words with Job's earlier utterances, they are not literally the words of Job, but a representation of what Sofer has heard Job say, filtered through his own understanding of what is at stake. The term translated as teaching, lekha, is a frequent term in Proverbs for the doctrines of the sages that are handed on, studied, and accepted as truth. From the agonized speeches uttered by a friend who is undergoing an extreme tragedy, all Sofer can hear is theology. At this point, the reader is compelled to respond to the thematic components of the character Sofer. What kind of person does he typify? David Klein's appropriately likens Sofer to the professional theologian who uses human misery as the raw data for academic point scoring. Sofer assures Job of his future restoration if he will reorient his entire person to God and reform his moral behavior. The four conditions that Sofer specifies are directing his heart toward God, spreading out his palms to God in prayer, putting away wrongdoing from his hand, and letting no deceit reside in his tent. Sofer's opinion about the appropriate behavior in suffering further develops the tensions in the story. Although Job has been addressing God directly in his previous speeches, Sofer presumably does not consider Job's words as legitimate prayer. The reader is induced to negotiate the validity of this theological tradition endorsed by Sofer. In summary, what are the arguments of Job's three friends in the first cycle? This question can be answered at two levels. At the narrative level, they seek to silence Job's complaint and to motivate him to conform to social norm in order to regain his former status. Unknowingly, they have picked up where the Satan has left off. If Job listens to their advices, the Satan will be right. There is indeed a causal relationship between prosperity and piety. At the rhetorical level, the author uses the arguments of the three friends as a springboard to criticize the fear generated in a religious community where the words of a member transgresses what is generally considered as acceptable expressions of faith. The unease causes other members in the community to defend a rigid system of ideological beliefs and to marginalize the voice of the outcast. I sincerely pray that you will not find any Eliphaz, Bildad, or Sofer in your congregation. Thank you. Yes.